means literally to think down. So it's a matter of the mind. To have an estimate of small children in our minds that underrates them. A generation ago, there was a very famous children's evangelist called Mr. Hudson Pope. I had the privilege of listening to him talking to several hundred children in his old age. There was no one like him in his generation, and no one has arisen to take his place. And his motto was, don't underrate the underrates. He could hold a church full of underrates spellbound for 50 minutes listening to a Bible exposition. I have never heard the like myself before or since. Don't underrate the underrates. Now, the reason is characteristically given, as always in the Bible, because their angels always behold the face of my Father in heaven, as Jesus says. The wayside pulpit, of course, gives reasons, doesn't it? The famous one is, don't worry, it may never happen. But the reasons of the wayside pulpit are, of course, quite fatuous. Because if you've ever had to counsel someone who is a natural worrier, you will know that that kind of reason gives them no comfort at all. The trouble is that it might happen. It's very characteristic of the fact that when churches turn away from the Bible, they put out sentences like that that have no weight in them at all. You've got the whole Bible full of the most wonderful sayings, so you put outside your church the wayside pulpit, which says something which is quite meaningless. But Jesus says, you're not to think down on little ones, and the reason their angels, that presumably means their guardian angels, always behold the face of my Father in heaven. In other words, they are the most privileged of all the great beings in heaven who serve the Father's throne. If you want to cross-reference there, this is not a sermon about guardian angels, but there is a very striking statement about Gabriel in chapter 1 of Luke, verse 19, just over a few pages, where the angel answered to Zechariah, I am Gabriel who stand in the presence of God, and I was sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. So the angel sent to Zechariah, and of course later to Mary, is Gabriel, well known in the early part of the gospel story. And the mark of this mighty angel is that he stands in the presence of God. So if you link that with chapter 18, verse 10, we're told that the guardian angels responsible for small children have immediate access into the presence of God. They're always before his face. That means he gives them the first place in his attentions, if we may say that ever of God. Now this great statement in Matthew 18 is not a platitude. It may seem to be a fairly obvious statement to us who live as the inheritors of a Christian civilization. But it is a commonplace of anyone who knows the ancient world to realize that Jesus revolutionized the attitudes of men to children. Of course, the Jewish attitude to the family and to children was always a high one because they had been taught by God through the law, through Moses, and through the prophets. And still today, Jewish family life has very high standards and very high ideals. But outside Judaism, in the great civilizations of Greek and the Roman Empire, the attitude to children was a lamentable one. Three things seem to have constituted the classical view of children in Greek civilization. First, they had little time for them. Children, small children, were left to grow up under the care of slaves, rather as the upper classes in the Victorian era left small children in the nursery to be brought up by nurses and nannies. If these children were to disturb their elders at meal or thought, then there was always a whip in the corner to apply to them. It was considered by cultivated people to be a waste of time to pay attention to children. In short, children were a burden. I wonder if there is anything in that that makes you feel rather uneasy as I say it. You see, when you lose your grip on the Christian faith, you will find society loses its grip on the special emphases of the Christian faith. And so in this regard, as our Western society loses its grip on the Christian faith, as it is doing, don't let's be deceived by the life we see in some churches. Our culture as a whole is moving away into humanism, away from Christianity. Then inevitably we shall see that children suffer. When the great days of the 18th century revival had finally spent their spiritual force, and you come to the early part of the Victorian era, You will find to your surprise, if you think of Victorian Christianity as being strong later on, that at that period in the 1840s and 50s, when, as I say, the spiritual tide had gone out and the Industrial Revolution had come in, children suffered exceedingly. If you wander around the manuscript halls in the British Museum, and there are few halls in the British Museum more fascinating, and see first editions of Alice in Wonderland and Winnie the Pooh and so on, you will find in the case given over to Karl Marx that the factory inspector's report on small children in Southwark and other places is given a very prominent place in this glass case. Indeed, from the horrific records of the factory inspectors, who incidentally were extremely honest men, they wouldn't be, of course, in a communist regime today. These sort of facts would be hidden. It is at least to the credit of that part of our history that the factory inspectors were so honest. If you read these little reports of little Billy and little Mary in 1840 and 1850, they were nothing short of little savages. They had no education, they had no parents, their teeth were rotting. They worked all their lives, putting dipping matches into whatever it was. And Marx made great capital from this in his writings. But of course, as anybody knows, who knows the history of 19th century England, it wasn't Marx who put it right. The people who put it right were Lord Shaftesbury and those like Dr. Barnardo of the London Hospital. And both Shaftesbury and Barnardo were, of course, keen Christians, converted Christians, regenerate Christians. The force, in other words, to put the situation right in the Victorian era, the credit does not belong to Karl Marx, but to Christian people. As I say, in Greek civilization, and when Christianity ebbs away, children become a burden again. And I'm not sure that we're not entering into that period today. Young couples are not so sure today that they want children. Of course, the expense of living in London is often great, but it's easily postponed. And if people do have children in our society today, it's all too easy to get others to care for them. And so, as you know, it is widely true that young mothers go out to work and put their children in day nurseries. And woe betide any government undersecretary who doesn't provide enough nurseries for them. The thing, of course, is Gilbertian, isn't it, in certain ways, as you get these people calling upon the government to do what is their own duty so often. So at any rate, there's the first sign of a Christian civilization ebbing away. Children become a burden and not a blessing. I remember once speaking at a conference in East Africa where a European mother was going around with her children. She had just had twins, and the other European mums were tending to commiserate her. It had been quite unforeseen. No insurance had been taken out, and she was facing rather a lot of work. And a great, loving, enormous African mother came up and said, "I'm so pleased for you. God has blessed you." Well, that puts a slightly more unsophisticated, but perhaps slightly more biblical view on the matter. Second thing that marked children in the Greek world was that they were amusing. Their drollness was quaint. Later in their culture, they used to have a great many statues of children, which was a favorite subject because they were roguish and merry. And so there were many statues made of children quarreling and thieving and so on. And it was particularly the rude health of children and their strength that made them attractive to the sculptor and to those who bought those things at the expensive shops in Athens in those days. The eye rested with complacent pleasure on children as playthings. I don't think there's any sign of that in our culture, I'm thankful to say. But it led on to the third thing, which was so common in the ancient way, the shameful ways of sexual perversion that were so common, especially with young boys, referred to in 1 Corinthians 6 that has just been read. It's always been a puzzle to historians why in the 6th century BC this kind of homosexual activity with small boys swept the whole ancient world and became, in fact, the commonest thing, so that the love of a boy was as ordinary as the love of a woman. And when Herodotus talks about it, it's one of the good things of life, and no one was in the least ashamed about it. No one hid it. Everyone took it for granted. No one questioned it. And girls suffered abuse, too, in those days of one of the highest intellectual societies the world has ever seen. Now, I wonder if you feel there's anything alarming in this today as our Christian tide ebbs out. For example, in Time magazine this month, September, the number for the 5th of September this month, this year, there are a number of quite horrific articles on wife beating and child abuse. In fact, the details of sexual assaults on daughters and children are so horrific that they couldn't be mentioned normally from a Sunday pulpit. In 1976, 10% of Americans recognized that this kind of thing had become a national problem. In a recent poll, 1983, 90% of Americans recognize this as a major national problem. In the article on children's abuse, the editor, the journalist, finishes like this. At stake is America's most precious asset, its human capital. At stake, too, is simple human dignity. If wolves and bears and birds take meticulous care of their young, why are human beings subjecting theirs to whippings and punching and sexual perversion? Children with their unrestrained love and unquestioning trust deserve better, says Sergeant Raymond, head of the Sex Crimes Unit of the Seattle Police Department. Child abuse is the ultimate crime, the ultimate betrayal. Now, just as that came in the Time magazine this month, so in the Times on Tuesday, if any of you read the Times regularly, you'll know that Tuesday is a great day, because it's the day when Roger Scruton writes his article, which is always one of the best things, and certainly worth twice the price of the Times. And I've had this copied, and there are copies of this at the back, and Roger Scruton writes When Intolerance Must Triumph, and writes an article on the paedophilia situation, as it's been reported in the picture in the papers in the last fortnight. It struck me very much as I was reading on this on Tuesday that the Times and articles like Roger Scruton's are becoming, in fact, the pulpits of our day. The church remains completely silent. I don't know if you've ever heard a bishop or church leader speaking on this whole matter in the last fortnight. I think you'd need a year trumpet to hear a whisper. But there are journalists of this kind who speak very plainly. It is uncertain how far the paedophile information exchange has gone in its attempts to gain the sympathy of the tolerant. But if it is true, as the organization apparently claims, that can now be contacted through the Citizens Advice Bureau, then it is surely time that the wishes of the intolerant, who in this matter constitute the overwhelming majority, were respected. So he goes on, and talks about how we should hate this thing, and not be tolerant. We should also hate much else that is inflicted on our children in the name of enlightened good sense. Consider, quote, sex education, unquote, that insidious propaganda devoted to freeing the sexual act from its moral overtones, to liberating our children from guilt, and to dressing up in surgical neutrality what can be neutrally regarded only by the childish and the insensible. To tolerate this outrage is also to connive at the loss of innocence, and so to lay aside responsibility for our children's future emotions. Let me say straight away, in defense of the bishops, that if any of the bishops had said anything as bold as that, it would have been a hornet's nest, and he wouldn't have been left alone by the TV all this week. Journalists apparently can do it more readily. Now, it's with this in mind, the attitude in the ancient world, an attitude that we begin to see seeping back into our Western culture, that I invite you to look at this passage, in particular, to see two things. I'm going to omit verses 1 to 4, which I think are very familiar and must often be preached about, and I want to look at verses 6 through 14, which is much less preached about, because it is indeed rather terrifying. And I want you to see that the attitude behind these two sections is that children very easily are led astray. They are weak and frail and naturally get pushed around and follow anybody who seems to be powerful. And there is a negative and a positive here. And first we start with a negative, a tremendous warning in our influence of children in verses 5 to 9. In particular, verse 6. Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it will be better for him. And then he describes the death of a dog or an animal. If you drowned an animal, indeed it still happens, doesn't it? You put a stone round its neck and throw them into the sea. But here, the great millstone is a millstone that literally is drawn by a donkey. That's what the Greek says. In other words, it's the upper great millstone. So he's using a very strong picture. And he says that before a person ever did an act like this, it would have been better if someone had got hold of them and put a millstone around their neck and taken them out into the middle of the channel and dumped them there. Now, it is this kind of sentence which gives us an insight, a window, doesn't it, into the mind of Jesus. It's so different from the Jesus that I was brought up to believe in, that meek and mild and harmless creature that could be tucked away in church on Sunday morning and nobody need worry about him. There is a fierce intolerance, isn't there, in this sentence. You can only call it fierce. And yet that is the thing that is missing, isn't it? It's interesting that Roger Scruton in his article calls for intolerance. I therefore looked up my most learned dictionary, modern dictionary on tolerance, my dictionary of ethics, and there was a very good page on tolerance, speaking of the value of tolerance in religious differences of opinion, which is of course right, but I looked in vain for any paragraph in my dictionary on the necessity also for intolerance, because of course the Bible teaches both. Both the need to tolerate those who have different opinions of ours on minor matters, but the need to be intolerant of those who disbelieve major matters of faith and ethics. See, that's utterly unbalanced, isn't it? And yet utterly characteristic of the 1980s. There is then here a fierce intolerance. I want you to notice, too, the realism of all this. You see, look at verse 7. Woe to the world for temptation. It seems here, incidentally, that Matthew has gathered together various bits of material from the teaching of Jesus. It's unlikely that Jesus went straight through these very concentrated sentences straight off. Probably Matthew is gathering from sermons and from notes taken down and putting together some of the things that Jesus said about this very important subject. And here he looks at the realism of Jesus. Verse 7, woe to the world for temptations to sin, for it is necessary that temptations come. In other words, Jesus lived in the real world. He knew that this would be the case. Doesn't blind himself to it. Doesn't put on blinkers. Doesn't pretend like the Christian Science Monitor to live in a world where those things don't happen, or the world of Mrs. Mary Baker Eddy, or the world indeed of some extreme Christians today who seem to live in a world where nothing really evil happens. No, he knows that these things happen, but responsibility is nevertheless pinned upon those who are responsible. He doesn't say, because the tide is going strongly this way, I can therefore plead that I have been pushed by the tide and I have some measure of excuse because I couldn't stand up to the current viewpoint. All medics take note of this. There's no excuse, you see, in the Bible that I follow the current viewpoint of behavior, that because ethics allows this, I will go with it. Because many very eminent people say this, I will therefore agree with them. If they are wrong, then the responsibility is mine to stand up against it. Yes, these temptations will come, but woe to the man by whom the temptation comes. And then some more teaching, which is used in another parts of the Gospels, and that Jesus must often have used very, very frequently. If your hand or foot causes you, that is something that is perfectly good in itself. He's not talking about sins. He's talking about good things. Yet if these things cause you to sin, lead you astray, well then cut them off. Again, you see, that is a very vigorous, almost a ferocious demand, isn't it, for renunciation, even of good things, if they lead us astray. One might think of alcohol. I'm not myself a total abstainer. I don't think that the Bible teaches that. But there are some people, and you will know this if you have any duty in counseling people, in medicine or in social work, there are some people who simply cannot touch a drink. Now, there are other less obvious things than that. And so if it may be a good thing in my life that I must vigorously renounce, if it is going to lead me to sin so that I lead other people to sin. Of course, this is metaphorical. There was one of the early fathers who castrated himself because he was so bored with his own sexual temptations. I'm sure Jesus is not talking about any physical mutilation here. But he is calling for a very vigorous self-watch. Said, I come to know my own weaknesses. I come to know my own life. I come to know myself. It may be that other people can get away with things that I cannot. See, notice the fierce denunciations on this sin, the realism behind it, and the vigorous demand for self-discipline. Now, we need to know this divine attitude, this warning. There's no vagueness here. There are no easygoing attitudes, no fudging. What we're told here in these verses of warning is that there are certain things that God hates. We might say that he hates with every fiber of his infinite being. It is striking to think of God in those terms. Theologians have often made God very passive, sort of sitting in infinite light, not feeling anything in particular. Well, that's not the God of the Bible. And we're called upon to share his attitudes. Now, I asked Prem to read from Jonah in the Old Testament reading today, because it is very striking that at the beginning of that short book, Jonah is called to go to Nineveh and cry against it. And there are some people who foolishly look at a story like this and imagine that it is simply Old Testament judgment, something that the New Testament doesn't deal with. But actually, when you read the story more carefully, you find that the reason he's called to cry against Nineveh is because God has compassion upon Nineveh and wants to bring revival and forgiveness there. God is compassionate, we're told at the end of Jonah, on the 120,000 people there who don't know their right hand from their left, and that may have been the children. Now you see how God's compassion is manifested. God's compassion is manifested by crying against the sins of that people. Now has the church understood that in this part of the 20th century? I would say the church has completely forgotten that. Indeed, I would suggest that if you read sociology or any of these things today at college or university, you will never get this element in compassion put before you in the lectures. Never. Compassion as it's taught today is a bloodless thing. It seems to be good. But the compassion of Almighty God is a compassion that takes sin seriously and calls upon the church to cry against it in order that he may have mercy upon repentant people. So there's the first of these sections on little children. A tremendous warning, a crying against these things by Jesus Christ, therefore calling upon the church to do the same. We mustn't leave it, therefore, to the Times on Tuesday morning. We mustn't leave it to American journalists to put out the facts and the statistics. Christians also are called to cry against these things and to preserve themselves from entering into those temptations. Secondly, I want you to notice not only a tremendous warning, but a tremendous appeal. You'll find this in verses 12 to 14. Now, here's a very familiar parable. Again, a parable, surely, that our Lord told on many occasions, the Good Shepherd. We normally remember it in Luke 15. But here it is, possibly in its original place, when talking about children. And I love the way it begins here in verse 12. And again, this surely must have been characteristic of the teaching of Jesus. And Matthew notes it down. What do you think? A good thing, isn't it, if all sermons preached today in all churches started with "what do you think?" Many churches where you don't think at all, where you take your head off and you lock it under the chair when you come in, and then you take it up and put it on afterwards when you leave. But not in the New Testament. What do you think about this? Don't think down upon children. What do you think? Or what do you think? Not what do you feel. I'm not trying to work up your emotions. It's easy to be sentimental about children. Very few young mothers are sentimental about them, as far as my observation shows. Now, it's the application, isn't it, of the lost sheep, which is so striking in verse 14. It is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. Just two things, because our time is gone. First, children can perish. That is, sin and guilt can become real to little children. As the Bible is taught in Sunday school and Bible class and in the family, children can be awakened to a sense of wrong and right. Indeed, if you talk about wrong and right in your home, you will soon see that at a very, very young age, children are well aware of their responsibility for what they do and are ashamed of what they've done. Children can perish. We must take them seriously. And secondly, what is said? It is said that it is not God's will that this should happen. I remember going once to a Christian assembly in the Reigate area and asking the elders what they were doing about Sunday schools in their assembly, and he said with ineffable superiority, it seemed to me, "The Lord has not called us to do any work amongst children." Now, my dear friends, that's a complete misunderstanding of guidance, isn't it? You don't wait for God to call you to do certain things. The church doesn't wait for a call to do missionary work. That call has been given at the beginning of the Christian era. We don't wait to do something about children. We've been told what the will of the Father is. The Standard is running a number of articles, as you may know if you take an evening paper in London, there's only one left, on who's who in the pews of various churches. The media rather delight to find so few people in church, I think. There's a delightful one of St. Paul's Dock Street, just along the road here, on Wednesday evening. And Janice Morley, the journalist I know nothing of her, seems to be very sympathetic and writes quite a good article on the handful of people who go to church there. But she makes this comment in view of her evident researches in East London and especially in Tower Hamlets. There is no Sunday school teacher in this church. In fact, there is hardly a Sunday school in the entire borough. There are no church-related social groups, no guides, brownies, or scouts. Well, I have no, of course, knowledge of whether that's so or not. But if it is so, then it is surely a disgrace. I would not plead myself for children's work that is separated from the churches or from parents, because I think that's always less than the best. But it is surely a challenge to Christian people in East London if it is true that in Tower Hamlets there is virtually no Sunday school operative. If we must do children's work on its own, we must. I remember going to the great Muraman Convention in South India, which is, I suppose, one of the great Christian conventions in the world, with about 50,000 people sitting on the riverbed. The only meeting that was tolerable, as far as I was concerned, was the one at 7 in the morning. All the rest of the day is so hot that I just felt completely washed out. But at 7 in the morning, the meeting started, and you would come from your room where you'd been trying to sleep through the heat of the night, and you would see across this enormous riverbed, stretching miles in all directions, you would see little groups in colourful clothes. And one of the largest groups was children. The Children's Special Service Mission in India has a very long and honourable history, going back 100 years. And some of the elderly bishops of the Church of South India, the Martoma Church, would come up to you. They remain bishops until they die in that church. And so they're all incredibly antique. And some old bishop who looked about 103 came up to me, and he had a great beard down here, so it was very difficult to get through to him. And he leaned across to me, and I was sort of swamped by this beard. And through the hair, I heard him say that he'd been converted by the CSSM on the riverbed at a Muraman convention in whatever it is, 1861, or whenever the date was. Let's pray together, then we'll say the creed. Our gracious God, we thank you for sending Jesus Christ into the world, and we thank you for the influence that his teaching practice has had upon our view of children. We bring this subject to you and ask that question, what do you think, may be written on our hearts and minds today.